I'm Lina Ahmadu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will discuss two conditions that occur in the rectum, hemorrhoids and rectal cancer. Hemorrhoids are swelling and inflammation of the veins in the rectum and anus, which cause discomfort and bleeding. They are rarely dangerous, but can be very uncomfortable and painful. Rectal cancer often develops slowly over several years. It typically starts as a small abnormal growth on the inner lining of the rectum. This is called a polyp. Some polyps can eventually grow into cancer. For more on these issues, I spoke with Dr. Erin King-Mullins, a colorectal surgeon with the Georgia Colon and Rectal Surgical Associates and an expert with the American Society of Colon and Rectal Surgeons. Take a listen.
Dr. Erin King-Mullins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, good morning, Lenore. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Listen, we wanted to talk about two subjects that affect many people. Let's start with hemorrhoids. Very, very common. Help us understand what hemorrhoids are and what causes them.
So, you know, actually, everybody has hemorrhoid tissue. It's actually a natural part of our anatomy. And one of the things that people can often describe hemorrhoids as is like varicose veins of the anus and rectal area. But typically when people complain of having hemorrhoids, it's because they're having some sort of symptoms in the area. So they may be having some pain, bleeding, burning, itching, irritation, swelling. You know, there can be so many different things. And one important thing to note is just to say that whenever you have a symptom in the anal or rectal area, don't just assume it's hemorrhoids. It's best to obviously seek counseling from your physician to confirm that's what it is and that it's not another medical problem. When someone gets a hemorrhoid that's bothersome, typically it's gotten swollen in some sort of way. And it can cause bleeding. The little weak collections of blood vessels underneath the surface can cause swelling, irritation, or bleeding. And then really the determining factor on as to whether you should have any additional treatment for it really depends on the size, the type, the location, because there's a combination of internal and external hemorrhoids. So again, it still is very important to follow up with your physician to have an examination to confirm whether or not the symptoms you're feeling are due to hemorrhoids, and then to discuss what your options are.
Do they get to a point where they become fatal, like they turn into something else?
Some of the downstream effects of hemorrhoids when they get inflamed or angry can cause major medical problems. For example, someone who is having persistent bleeding from hemorrhoids, if they're bleeding so much so that they become anemic, then you can discuss some of the risks of that. This can be definitely more prominent in patients who are on some sort of blood thinning medications, you know, for heart disease, stroke, blood clots and things like that. Some patients may be on aspirin or other types of blood thinners that make the risk of bleeding greater. And so those are definitely situations where we should intervene to protect them from that. Also, if someone gets a degree of hemorrhoids that cause an infection, in certain patients who have an immune system that can't respond well, so patients who may have diabetes that's not under well control, patients who might be on steroid medications that have suppressed their immune system, or if they have other medical problems, like autoimmune diseases, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, various reasons that their immune system may not be strong enough, they can be at risk for worsening infections in the area if they develop an infection in their hemorrhoids. But in and of itself, it's very rare for hemorrhoids to actually get infected.
Are there some lifestyles, habits that can favor a hemorrhoid to become, whether it's infected or just inflamed, maybe food, some sort of diet?
So two of the main causes of aggravation of the hemorrhoids are the extremes of the bowels, so either having constipation or diarrhea. Other things, you know, there is some familial links to it. They have found there's no, like, direct gene that can be tied to it. But, you know, sometimes we see that hemorrhoids just run in families. Women who are in their childbearing years, pregnancy, that increased pressure and gravity that the uterus, you know, places on that area, actually having the delivery, the vaginal delivery, pushing, that can cause swelling, and increase in the hemorrhoids. Chronic heavy lifting can cause it. And especially nowadays with all of our attachments, meaning our tablets and phones, you definitely don't want to be, extending, have extended periods of time on the commode. So you really want to focus on using the restroom as a restroom, not a library, not your kind of social media catch up. You know, you want to use the restroom and not spend prolonged times on the commode. And you also don't want to rush it or force it. If you go to the restroom and you sit down and you feel that it's not quite time, your body's not quite ready, don't sit there and force it or rush it. Just kind of take your time, maybe get up, move around, go do something else, and then come back to use the restroom when it's time.
Can constipation be favorable to developing hemorrhoids?
Yes, definitely. Constantly pushing and straining, because again, underneath the surface, hemorrhoids are these weak collections of blood vessels. Again, some people kind of term them as varicose veins. And so if you're pushing and straining, that area can get engorged and get really swollen. And it actually can even get to the point where if one of those blood vessels ruptures underneath the surface, it can cause a little bit of a blood clot under the surface. And that can cause a lot of severe pain. And if the pressure builds up enough, it can actually kind of burst through the skin and cause some heavy bleeding. Now, mind you, the type of blood clot that can form, that thrombosis that's under the surface, it's not the type of blood clot that can go to the heart or the brain or the lungs that we concern about, you know, blood clots traveling, but it can definitely cause some severe pain and bleeding in that area.
So until someone can see the doctor, let's say, for example, someone has hemorrhoid and the doctor is only available to see them in 2 or 3 days, what can they do at home? What advice would you give them to manage it until they can see a doctor?
So first, don't go too hot and heavy on Google, Yahoo, or WebMD, because there's definitely some scary things out there. But the main things, if you truly think you have a hemorrhoid and nothing else, sitting in a warm tub of water or doing a hot compress in the area. And the reason that's important is because down in the anal rectal area, we have those muscles, those sphincter muscles that allow us to use the restroom. And so when something gets inflamed or angry down there, that muscle can really get into tight spasm. And so just as you would put a heating pad on a neck or a back that's spasming, you can put a hot compress or soak in a warm tub of water to allow that muscle to relax. The other side of things is ice packs. Those are a little bit more of a numbing sensation, more for pain relief in that way. So you can alternate heat and ice. If you found that either constipation or diarrhea caused it, you want to try your best to mitigate that. So if you're constipated, eating your fruits and veggies, lots of water, you can get a fiber supplement or some sort of natural remedy over the counter to help move the bowels. Other things, you know, if you don't have reasons that you can't take certain medicines over the counter, such as the acetaminophen, the ibuprofen, the naproxens, those class of NSAID medicines, those can help alleviate it as well. And then also there are some over-the-counter numbing medicines, like lidocaine medicines and things like that, that can be helpful in the area. I just wouldn't go too aggressive with trying over-the-counter things, especially if you're not 100% certain that you're dealing with a hemorrhoid, because other things can be going on that you can actually make worse if you do too many things. And so definitely you want to watch out if you're having fevers or chills or any other type of drainage or something from the area that can be a marker of an abscess or a fistula or something more serious. And so, you know, if you have any of those concerns while you're waiting to see a doctor, you may want to consider just going to an urgent care facility or the emergency department so that we're 100% certain of what we're dealing with.
We hear a lot about colonoscopy and colon cancer and everything, but rectal cancer seems to be a sort of cancer that we don't really hear a lot about. First of all, what's the difference between rectal cancer when we hear so much about colon cancer? What's the difference?
Sure, yes. And, you know, oftentimes the two are grouped together and classified as colorectal cancer. And so the rectum is the last portion of the colon. It's the part that leads to the very exit to the anal area. And the difference is that it's mostly enveloped down lower in the pelvis. And so there is some difference in treatment for it as opposed to colon cancer. But it's diagnosed in the same way as far as colonoscopy, looking on the inside. And it develops in a similar fashion as far as polyps, which are like little benign growths, almost like little molds that can grow on the internal lining of the colon and rectum. That's what eventually grows and turns into cancer. What we have been seeing over the past several years is an increase in the rates of rectal cancer, especially among young persons. And we don't know fully right now why that is the case. One of the important things to note and make sure we define it as rectal cancer as opposed to colon cancer is because what the thing that I had mentioned previously as far as the treatment being different. When we talk about rectal cancer, the options of treatment with regard to radiation come more into play, as well as the steps by which you treat someone for the disease. And so in certain cases, a patient may require chemotherapy and radiation or a combination of the two prior to surgery, or a patient may require surgery first and then follow it up with chemotherapy or radiation or a combination thereof. Whereas with colon cancer, the colon is truly fully inside the abdomen or the abdominal cavity. It's higher up, so it's surrounded by multiple other organs and things like that. And so radiation doesn't so much come into play with treatment for that because of the risk of injury to the nearby structures. So that's just kind of a broad aspect of the difference between the two.
What are the causes for rectal cancer?
Very similar to the causes for colon cancer as far as family history. That will play a role. If someone has any genetic abnormalities, that could be family related as well. A history of having radiation to the area for another reason. For example, men who have had prostate cancer who get radiation, even though things are very good in getting targeted these days, as well as for women who have had like vaginal or vulvar cancer, some of the treatments are with radiation, where some of the radiation can affect the rectum. Also, people who have a history of longstanding Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, chronic inflammation can lead to rectal cancer or colon cancer. But the overwhelming majority of patients who are diagnosed with it, we don't have an isolated source. And so that's why after a certain age, now the new recommendation is 45 to start screening. And just a brief note on screening. Screening truly means that someone has no symptoms and they're just at risk for having a polyp or a cancer at that time. So we're going to look. They're not having any symptoms. But if someone has a family history, or if somebody had some of those other pre-existing conditions we just mentioned, screening may actually have to start sooner because the risk of developing problems may begin sooner. But also having a low threshold to perform what we call as a diagnostic colonoscopy, meaning if someone has symptoms, rectal pain, rectal bleeding, a chronic change in their bowel habits, those are reasons that we perform what we call as a diagnostic colonoscopy, meaning you're going to look and diagnose why they're having that problem.
Just to be clear, colonoscopy covers diagnosis for colon cancer as well as rectal cancer?
Yes. And also very important because the lowest part of the rectum is accessible by basic physical examination in the office. It's very important to utilize that as well. When you see a physician, they can do a rectal exam. And if it's low enough, if there's a problem, it can actually be felt with a finger.
What is the survival rate for rectal cancer and who's most at risk?
And so the survival rates are going to vary definitely based on the stage at which someone is diagnosed. And so, for example, the earliest stage or stage one, we have about a 90% five-year, you know, survival rate. And as the stage goes up, that survival rate, you know, really decreases. And as far as those at risk, It's going to be those who have a family history. And so if someone, for example, in your family was diagnosed with rectal cancer at the age of 45, and we're talking more immediate relatives like parents, siblings, children, you know, not too far past the second degree relative, but you actually have to start your screening earlier at the age of 35 because you are at increased risk. So family history plays a role. Again, having radiation therapy to the area for any other reason, having chronic inflammation of the colon and rectum due to either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, those are all things that will increase someone's risk. Or if you've had a personal history of either breast cancer, prostate cancer, or some other medical problem, you know, your physicians may need to check you for a genetic reason that you might be more at risk for colon or rectal cancer.
And finally, Dr. King-Mullen, what do you say to people who are afraid to see a doctor for fear of being diagnosed with rectal cancer? What is your advice?
I definitely understand that fear. You know, the C word, cancer, is a very, very scary word. And so if you don't even consider doing it for yourself, consider doing it for your family, because a diagnosis of colon cancer, rectal cancer, or even polyps really has a direct impact on your family. And they, you know, can be affected not only obviously because of your diagnosis, but also in having to have themselves be tested, you know, earlier or more frequently. But also there's power in knowing. Again, if we catch things early, it's fully treatable and we can get you back to, you know, living a nice, healthy, you know, life. You know, if things are persist to a degree in which it's difficult to treat, you know, that's the scariest aspect of all.
Dr. Erin King-Mullen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you as well, Lenore. Have a great day.
That was colorectal surgeon Dr. Erin King-Mullins discussing hemorrhoids and rectal cancer. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Uganda officials are scrambling to find more COVID-19 vaccine, as many medical stores have run out of supplies, leaving only enough to last a few days at most. Catherine Nembe reports from Kampala.
Many were at first reluctant to get the vaccine, but a resurgence in COVID-19 cases over the past few weeks has sparked a dash to get jabbed. Uganda procured 964,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine under the COVAX facility, but medical stores say their stocks are mostly gone. Dr. Alfred Drewali is the program manager of Uganda National Expanded Program on Immunization.
About 90 districts have used all the vaccine stocks they have. We also now know most districts have run out of stock, and those who are holding the balance of vaccines, majority of them are having doses in small quantities.
The shortage coincides with India banning exports of AstraZeneca. Drewali says the government is working round the clock to find another supply of the vaccine as soon as possible.
So we are expecting another consignment of vaccines on 14th of this month, and that can take us for another 1 or 2 weeks, and then the hunt continues for more vaccine doses.
Drewali says the first priority for expected vaccines will be Ugandans who qualify for a second AstraZeneca jab. Uganda is also looking at Johnson & Johnson, Sinovac, and other vaccine options. Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister. She says vaccine shortages are a general problem across Africa. Acheng adds that the government has already ordered more doses.
I want to believe that every African country is worried, not only Uganda, because we are all having difficulty in accessing vaccines, and the government of Uganda has gone ahead to place in orders. To date, the government of Uganda has placed in 5 million through the African Union. Hopefully, we can place in more as resources keep on coming.
Available statistics indicate that only 1.7% of Uganda's population has been able to at least get the first COVID-19 jab. According to World Health Organization, 47 African countries, including Uganda, might fail to meet the target of 10% vaccination of their populations by September. WHO says about 225 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines are needed on the continent urgently amid surges in new cases. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Zimbabwe's government on Monday is reintroducing a lockdown as a way to contain rising coronavirus cases in the southern African nation. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Announcing the reintroduction of the lockdown Saturday night on national television, Vice President Constantino Chiwenga said complacency had resulted in a recent spike in cases of the coronavirus responsible for the COVID-19 disease.
In addition, our vaccination against COVID-19 is going on very well. The country is, however, experiencing a surge in cases. The last 7 days have seen 596 new cases and 26 deaths as compared to the same period in May last year, where we had 132 new cases and 6 deaths.
Chiwenga, who doubles as Zimbabwe's health minister, said all gatherings except for funerals would be banned come Monday. Only 30 people would be allowed at funerals. He did not indicate when the new measures would be reviewed. Itairu Sike, head of non-profit community working group on health in Zimbabwe, commended the government for tightening the lockdown to avoid a pending third wave disaster.
Yes, this may look a bit draconian, but the measures are still necessary if we are to save lives. So it is important that the people of Zimbabwe should embrace these measures. It is also important for those Zimbabweans that are eligible to be vaccinated to come forward and willingly, you know, get vaccinated if the country is to move towards, you know, achieving the herd immunity of vaccinating at least 60% of the population, which translates to about 10 million Zimbabweans.
Zimbabwe's vaccination effort against the infection has recently been hit by shortages of the shots. But officials say the country still has stocks of the 1.7 million vaccines it has received from China, Russia, and India since February. Last week, Zimbabwe received 25,000 Sputnik doses from Russia. That was a few days after it rejected Johnson & Johnson vaccines from the African Union, financed by the African Export-Import Bank. Zimbabwe has 39,852 confirmed coronavirus infections and 1,632 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
In addition, our vaccination against COVID-19 is going on very well. The country is, however, experiencing a surge in cases. The last 7 days have seen 596 new cases and 26 deaths as compared to the same period in May last year, where we had 132 new cases and 6 deaths.
Yes, this may look a bit draconian, but the measures are still necessary if we are to save lives. So it is important that the people of Zimbabwe should embrace these measures. It is also important for those Zimbabweans that are eligible to be vaccinated to come forward and willingly, you know, get vaccinated if the country is to move towards, you know, achieving the herd immunity of vaccinating at least 60% of the population, which translates to about 10 million Zimbabweans.
The beleaguered COVID-19 vaccine rollout for South Africa and the entire continent has been dealt another hard blow. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, has declared millions of Johnson & Johnson jabs currently in storage at a South Africa port and suitable for use. The doses, along with millions more that were to be distributed across Africa, were produced in Baltimore by a firm called Emergent Biosolutions, which has been tainted by a contamination issue. Darren Terrell reports.
At the beginning of the year, deal after deal for vaccines fell through for the South African government. Then, when it finally got millions of AstraZeneca jabs, they weren't effective against the highly infectious variant in South Africa and were sold to other countries. When the state received 500,000 J&J shots, the FDA temporarily suspended their use, following concerns the vaccine caused blood clots. Now the country's lost 2 million J&J shots contained at the port of Gqeberha. Abeda Williams is spokesperson for J&J South Africa.
What will happen to the doses? So we're going to destroy all the product that has been earmarked by the regulatory authorities, and we're not going to give it to any country. What is good for one country must be good for all countries. We don't feel it's fair to give it to a country, even if they would want to accept it. So we none of those batches.
J&J contracted Aspen Pharmacare to package the vaccines in Gqeberha. Aspen's senior executive, Stavros Nicolaou, confirmed to VOA that other than the South African allocation of 2 million, there were several million more that were supposed to have been used across Africa. Williams says these will also be destroyed.
We've been cautious. All the batches are not contaminated. There was one batch that was contaminated that was destroyed, and the other batches, we've just been cautious that we'd rather not send them out.
She declined to disclose the exact quantity of vaccines to be destroyed or to name all African countries affected.
We've contained the issue. We're working with the governments. We're looking at our supply chain. How we communicate to the public has to be cautious because there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy. And if we scare the public, they're not going to take any vaccine, which is not going to be helpful.
Some scientists have called the J&J jab a game changer for the continent. It's the only vaccine that doesn't require a second booster injection. It also doesn't need super cold refrigeration. But the US FDA has shut the Baltimore plant that was set to produce 220 million J&J shots for Africa, effectively ending the continent's supply until J&J is able to bolster production elsewhere. Fatima Hassan, a lawyer who heads the Health Justice Initiative, says J&J owes South Africa an immediate supply of 2 million FDA-approved vaccines.
The U.S. government funded the research for Johnson & Johnson. The U.S. government has the ability and the power within its own domestic rules and context to actually take action against Johnson & Johnson. And I think that Johnson & Johnson owes the South African public, as well as the rest of Africa, an explanation and I think also an apology.
Hassan says the loss of millions of J&J vaccines in Africa will undoubtedly cause thousands of deaths.
The facts playing out on the ground shows a dire situation of a lack of access, not just in South Africa, but the rest of Africa. And we relied on companies that told us that they've got it under control, that they have enough manufacturers, that they have enough supplies, that they will be able to meet all of our demands. But clearly, we put too much faith in the market and we put too much faith in the CEOs of these companies, and they've really let us down.
Williams says the FDA has approved 300,000 doses of its vaccine for use in South Africa, and those will be delivered later this week. The U.S. government has also pledged to send stocks of Pfizer jabs to the country. G7 country leaders have promised 870 million vaccines to poorer nations. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenor Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe and wash your hands more frequently and strive to make every day a healthy day.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.